Welcome to Bridge the Gap with host Josh and Lucas, a podcast dedicated to informing, educating, and influencing the future of housing and services for seniors, powered by Markentum. If you love listening to Bridge the Gap, we have a special offer for you. Josh and Lucas will be recording live at the Interface Southeast Conference in Atlanta, August 29th. The conference focuses on the state of senior housing investment, development, operations, and financing across markets, and will provide excellent networking. If you'd like to meet Josh and Lucas and see firsthand how the podcast is created, register for Interface using promo code BTG and receive 5% off your registration.
All right, welcome to Bridge the Gap podcast. We have an exciting show on tap for you guys today. Here are my co-host Joshua Crist. How's it going, man?
Having a great time, Lucas. It's awesome. You know, I'm excited about our guest today. It's a topic that's always near and dear to my heart. Looking forward to getting a little bit of education myself on some market updates, but always good to be with you, my friend.
Absolutely. We got a heavy hitter on our show today, and I want to welcome just a very special guest today, Tim Sanders. Thank you for being on the show.
No, thanks, guys, for having me. This is very exciting. Obviously, you know, doing a podcast is a bucket list stuff, so pretty exciting to be here. I guess by way of starting, I'll give you a little bit of my background.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I've been a finance guy my entire career. Started in seniors housing in 2001. Like most people in the senior housing business, kind of fell into it, didn't really know it existed, had been doing all types of commercial real estate. And a friend of mine that I'd worked with in banking had been, he was working at Heller doing portfolio management and wanted somebody who had real estate experience, hired me. Started there in May of 2001. In August of 2001, it was announced that GE Capital was buying Heller. That deal closed in October. So really for, you know, the 5 years I was there, I started at Heller, but really spent most of my time at GE Capital doing portfolio management, and then I ran the national sales team. So I was an originator doing senior housing transactions in all the asset classes, skilled, assisted, memory care, the whole kit and caboodle. Left in 2006 to start working at a hedge fund. We wanted to do a senior housing group company called Marathon Asset Management.
Okay.
Worked there for 2 years. The wheels fell off the economy in 2008, and as hedge funds are known to do, they shut us down. Then I caught on at the depth or height, depending on your perspective, of the recession with a HUDSHA, a capital funding group based in Baltimore. Ran their bridge lending business for 6 years. And then 3 years ago, rejoined my GE boss, John Cobb, at Ventas, who's our chief investment officer. He got the band back together and came over to Ventas, and I've been there since February of 2015.
Excellent, excellent. And I believe, just for our audience to know, so your title, I think, is Senior Investment Officer.
Senior Investment Officer, that's right.
Excellent, excellent. So a very diverse background. And just by way, so the people that are listening into the podcast, you may hear a little background noise, but for the ones that are watching this on YouTube, I want to give a little context. So Tim and I are actually in Chicago. Tim, you live in Washington, D.C.
I do. Right? Washington, D.C. suburbs.
Okay.
That's right.
Okay. So Tim and I have been connecting on LinkedIn, and I've seen him from afar at Nick. I kind of looked, I was like, there's that Tim guy. I got to meet him one day. there's a lot of people around him. And so we connected on LinkedIn, and you ran it through your traps, and you said, yes, you know what? This is something that I want to do. I want to, you know, be a part of the show and help give back. And then Josh, where we're normally together, my friend. Missing you here in Chicago, but you're at your home base there in Knoxville, Tennessee. But the audio will be seamless, but for the YouTube listeners, that kind of gives some context to where we are. And we're actually enjoying, since it is 5 o'clock somewhere, enjoying a nice cold beverage. So moving along from there, hey, Josh, you're on mute, man. There you go. Perfect. So moving along from there, you've got a tremendous knowledge base and background in not just senior living, but in the investment space. Josh, you have done a lot of different things in the space and a lot of new initiative things that you're trying to do. What can we ask Tim to kind of pick his brain about the inner workings of the beast of, you know, investments and capital on a very big scale?
Well, I'll first say we could have a lot longer show with Tim than what we have today. This could be multiple parts, but you know, I think I'm always wanting to take the opportunity when I have guys like Tim to talk to get, you know, what's the latest, greatest, what's your gut feeling, what's your thoughts on the market. I think a lot of the operators, I'll just speak for operators, although we've got a lot of different listeners, developers, owners, a lot of stakeholders, and even consumers. But, you know, I feel like, you know, my cohorts, we're talking about we feel this kind of change coming, you know, the wind's blowing a change, whether we're talking about acquisitions or whether we're talking about developing and what's going to be relevant for now, but ready for the next generation that's coming in. So, you know, I've got some general market questions for you, Tim, on just kind of what's your gut and what you're seeing out in the market a lot of lately that's coming across your desk. And then I would love to pick your brain a little bit about something that Lucas and I talk a lot about. And I think one of the ways that you guys connected on LinkedIn was a post that Lucas made on multi-generational housing, because there's a lot of people talking about it, something mm-hmm. I'm very passionate about. And there's a few people trying actively to develop models. But I think one of our biggest challenges is because a true multi-generational model crosses several financial platforms, right? From your potentially your retail, your multifamily, your single family, your healthcare side. So how you package all that together and what might be models that we would consider and pathways to get on course to actually pull some deals together. So that's just a couple of things that I would like to start. Maybe we could talk with some general thoughts on market conditions right
now. Sure. That's a great place to start. right now I think it's kind of an interesting time in the market. It's very hot. There's a lot of capital chasing, you know, a lot of deals right now. I'm sure you guys saw that Kayne Anderson, the big private equity shop down in Florida, just raised $1 billion. Not all of it is earmarked for for senior housing. Some of it's for student housing, but they do have a senior housing component. They've done a lot of senior housing. So that's a lot of capital in the space. Then you have all the traditional players, the REITs, the commercial finance companies, your traditional private equity, as well as some foreign capital. So in terms of what we're seeing, you see a lot of kind of one-off deals in some tertiary and secondary markets. And then there's, you know, a few portfolios, not as many big portfolios in the past, but you have some trophy assets to trade as well. I think the interesting thing is my take, you asked me about my gut. One of the things that I see happening is a couple of things I want to touch on. First and foremost, I think that there's going to be a big push into what have been traditionally known as secondary markets. Your Nashvilles, your Pittsburghs, Baltimore, places like that, places down south, Charlotte. And the reason that I say that is a big driver in our business is adult children. They are typically the primary decision makers in this case, either financially or because the residents want to be near their grandchildren and their families. Historically, people have wanted to live on the edges, Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, Boston, Washington. But millennials and the next wave of young professionals are getting priced out of those markets, getting very, very expensive. So they're starting to find their way toward the secondary markets, and jobs are starting to follow them as well. So it seems natural that senior housing is going to follow next because, as I said before, people want to be near their adult children and their families, and that's where people can afford to live. So I think you're going to see more development and acquisition in those markets.
Interesting.
The other thing that I think is kind of a challenge in our space right now is the technology wave. All the technology that's coming online is really geared toward the ability to age in your home, be it robots, be it drones, FaceTime, then the Uber. You know, Uber, one of the things with seniors is you lose your independence. Now with Uber-type apps, people can pick you up and take you to doctor's appointments, take you around. So with that in mind, the next wave of development is really going to have to figure out a way to marry the technology, because one of the things that we have as a competitive advantage is socialization. We don't do a good job as an industry of selling it. We tend to sell the care and the help. But those are the things that are going to be more easily targeted by technology. But socialization is something that you really can't address through technology. People want to be around other people. It's much like the movie business, right? When videos and online movies became popular, people said, well, theaters are going to go out of business. But there's still something about people wanting to see big blockbuster films in a theater with other people who they don't even know. But it's just a feeling of community of being in a movie theater.
Sure.
And that's kind of what's going to happen with senior housing if we figure out and start to do a better job of selling the social aspects of it. I read a statistic that said, I think it was, I can't remember the university, but the key was that loneliness is a bigger health concern for senior citizens than obesity and smoking. And loneliness is the one thing that our business can really counteract. So I say the next wave of development, I think you're going to see more ability to marry technology with the real estate and address the care that way.
Very good. Very good.
That's great stuff. That is great stuff. So, you know, as it applies right now, you touched on several things, the decision makers, secondary markets being, I think a pop place. And you talked about technology, but it was interesting that you talked about how we apply that and how we apply that to socialization and so forth. You know, in our industry, I feel like we've talked about technology a lot on this this podcast, Lucas, and we talk about technology in general and things like that. And I think as operators, man, there's so much technology getting flooded to us all at one time. It's hard to pick what's the right technology. You know, not all technology right, and got to be methodical. And then the loneliness issue, we've seen that over and over again. Some of the points that you're talking on, when you particularly start talking about loneliness and technology and socialization, to me, that's been some of my rationalization, and some of the others, the guests that we've had on, it's actually, we haven't even had the topic talking about what's next generation housing look like, but it's led us to talking about that because of these issues and how do we attack that. And some of that has led us to the topic of multi-generational housing. And so I'm interested to know your thoughts, you know, on the topic of multi-generational housing from a lender's point of view, because I'm sure you've got your, you know, your Tim hat on, and then you've got your Tim investment banker hat on. Are they the same, or are they one? Are they separate? Do you have different conflicting opinions on it, or what?
Oh, that's a great point. The reality is they're pretty much one and the same. I think my approach to problem solving and the way that I look at transactions, I think it crosses both. You know, you say there's Tim and then there's Ventas Tim. I mean, they're pretty much one and the same. Obviously, here I'm representing, you know, just Tim, but I'm still Tim who works at Ventas. That being said, multi-generational is something that's very intriguing from an investment standpoint. I think it solves or addresses one of the things we talked about, which is the loneliness and also the ability for families to stay together while addressing the care need. Because everyone's natural inclination is to care for their parents in their home. And there's still a fair amount of guilt associated with senior housing as a product. But the reality is, based on acuity and the need, there comes a point where you have to have someone needs care. Multi-generational allows you, I think, to kind of assuage some of that guilt and address the care at the same time. That being said, I think there are also some design implications that have to be addressed. Because when you talk multi-generational, let's say some of the models I've seen, you have just call it a 15-story building. And the first five floors, the first six floors are senior housing, and then everything above is just your typical multifamily where you can have singles, young families, or adult children living there. So theory being, your grandkids can go and see their grandparents, you can go check on your parent, vice versa. But there are also different needs along that spectrum. For instance, the people who are living in the market rate units above may not be comfortable with inevitably ambulances coming through the building and stretchers or walkers and wheelchairs and things like that. Conversely, the seniors, you know, with the shared common space may not be comfortable with children at the pool. And, you know, kind of where they are in life, they maybe want a little more quiet. So I think from a design perspective, what could work is where you have more of a shared campus. So you have a senior building, and then you have a regular multifamily building or housing, and then you have some shared common space where people can interact with one another. Maybe you have like a pool, and much like regular swimming pools, you have hours where this is going to be only for the seniors, things like that. So everybody's able to feel comfortable in their own home, yet coexist together. You know, there's a model out in California that they're calling co-housing,
okay,
where you have 12 to 14 small houses or cottages that people own, and then they have just a shared common space, and it's all seniors. So they're addressing the socialization,
yeah,
but you still have your own space, but people come and go and visit each other. It's very much like a senior housing building, but you have your own space. Right now, I think there's something like 13 of these kind of co-housing properties around the country. So I think there's going to be different ways to kind of address housing and the multi-generational piece, you know, so because you could do kind of that co-housing model I just talked about, and that could be multi-generation, where half of the units are senior housing and half of the units are just regular families.
Yeah.
So, like I said, it's very intriguing, but I think, you know, for it to work, you have to be very cognizant of the needs of each of your cohorts and design the buildings accordingly.
Yeah. So it's a design play. And Tim, do you think that this is something, are these major urban markets that this works in, or does this happen in more of a tertiary kind of a country setting?
That's a great question, Lucas. From my perspective, I think it's definitely an urban product.
Yeah.
Because most of the younger cohorts, especially those with young children, are not going to want to live too far out. I mean, you're already seeing it outside of senior housing and real estate in general, with the influx of people back into city centers and urban areas. Also, that product allows seniors to have more freedom and flexibility, because now you have the ability to walk, or as I said earlier, take an Uber or a cab to cultural and restaurants and movie theaters, things like that. So you still feel part of the community, and you have some semblance of independence because it's much easier to get around.
Gotcha.
So you guys may have touched on this, and you'll have to forgive me because y'all are obviously having a good time in Chicago where you guys are, and I can hear it about as much as I can hear you guys. So I may have missed a little bit of what you're touching on, but let's speak just very specifically, because I've been in circles with a lot of owner-operator developer types that kind of have this vision. And, you know, they're saying the same things, which is good, that you're saying, of urban model works, a secondary model works, and maybe looking at a property at a site, and they're already in the design phase because they are developing prototypes where they think, you know, hey, we can pull together the things that we know are going to be appealing to the different age group. There's ways that we can formally bring people together, and then there's ways that just organically the community comes together because of the space and how it's designed, how it invites the public in. But we all start scratching our heads when we start thinking, okay, I've got retail in this design, I've got a single housing family component, I've got a wellness center that's like a membership gym, I have a restaurant, I have independent housing, I have a small section of memory care back here tucked over in the corner, and I've got a parking garage underneath. You know, it's like looking at this, and it becomes a massive, you know, multi-million dollar development. And it's a little bit daunting to figure out how you stack that and how you bring people together to make the project work. So what kind of question should we as owners, operators, developers be prepared to answer, you know, when we start bringing a project to the financial institution, financial market? What are you guys going to want to know about that project?
Another great question. And I think as you were walking through that, the first thing that popped in my head when you start talking about all those various components, what do the return expectations look like? Mm-hmm. Because each of them are going to have different expense and revenue associated with them. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's a scenario where you repurpose some existing real estate. You know, obviously with what's going on with retail in general, you know, is it a strip, you know, failing strip centers, or, you know, failing, you know, like a mall, something like that. And the reason that I say that is when you start talking about urban real estate, right now, very pricey. So based on what your land basis is going to be, layer on the cost of development, can you really make a return that's going to justify that utilizing the space in that way? Or is there a better, higher use? So the first question you're going to have to ask, is this the best and highest use for the real estate in question? And once you get past that, it becomes, how much space do you need? How do you then divide it up and design the property in a way that it works most effectively? But more importantly, how do you assess the demand? Because if you think about kind of a multi-generational, multifaceted project like you're describing, where you have retail, single family, and all the various components of senior housing, each of those have different demand drivers. So now you're going to need multiple market studies to make sure that you can get this thing leased up and or sold in a way that you can meet the return expectations that I talked about earlier.
Yeah.
So first and foremost, is it the right project for that location? And then is there enough demand there across all of those various components that you're talking about?
Yeah, very interesting. Go ahead, Josh.
No, that's very interesting. And so I think that's going to be the real secret sauce, because, you know, I think at least a lot of the models I'm seeing, they're very appealing. The feedback you get from people that they're asking questions on. But then the giant question is, how do you fund it? You know, how do you bring all these multiple disciplines together also to work together, you know, to be a synergistic model? So switch gears a little bit here, Lucas, if you don't mind, because I've got a lot of questions for Tim and I don't want to run out of time. But so right now, there's so much new development going on. I'm amazed that how much product is going up right now in a lot of markets. Where do you feel, I keep hearing that acquisitions are soon to be a big game, and being able to take deals and reposition them and turn them around, but it still feels like, to me at least, it's still a seller's market. What are you seeing right now, and what do you think's coming as far as new development versus acquisition?
Interesting. I think it's probably more market driven. You know, obviously, development is going to be more attractive to people, kind of infill, where you're kind of in higher barrier to entry markets, i.e., kind of some of these downtown urban markets where there's going to be less competition, because either one, the cost of the land, availability of the land, or the cost, the labor costs, things like that. However, when you look at, you know, some places that don't have as many restrictions on development, i.e. the Texases of the world, where you can do a development and then somebody else can come in and do one. I mean, that's kind of where it gets scary. I mean, I see a lot of development deals in places like Florida and Texas, Georgia, places that have historically, or not historically, but right now are kind of overbuilt. But yet these projects tend to get funded. So that's a little scary. I think something that you hit on earlier has got some real value is acquisition and repositioning. There's a lot of product out there that's, you know, older. It's kind of dated. It needs, you know, a refresh. Now, those, you know, with the real estate, the guts of the building are good. They're in a great location. And they're, you know, not leasing up, or occupancy has been bad because the real estate just, you know, is not in good shape. Those you can kind of come in. You can buy them right, put a few dollars in, flip them around, and all of a sudden you increase the value. But the question that has to be asked on a reposition is, why is the occupancy bad? Is it a bad market, or is it a bad operator? If it's a bad market, there's not a lot that you're going to be able to do to increase value. But if it's just a bad operator, that's a solvable problem, where you can come in, you can figure out what the operator did wrong, correct some of those things, give the building a refresh, and put the right operator in, and all of a sudden you've created value on a much lower basis than development. Because the thing that's also to be factored in with development, labor costs and material costs. But right now, you know, unemployment is really low, so the cost of labor to getting things done is very expensive. Cost of materials is getting higher and higher. So all those things drive up your cost per square foot to build, the stem filters through that you need higher rents, lower expenses, more NOI to get a decent return.
Yeah.
So I think acquisition, to me, is much a much clearer path to assess return and success. What I mean by that is, if you're selling me or I'm looking to buy a broken building, that's a lot easier for me to kind of figure out what needs to be done and what business plan is going to work to make that a successful building versus ground up development. Unless you're in a market where the demand is easily quantifiable, it's going to be a lot more difficult to determine whether or not that project is going to be successful.
Exactly.
Because most market studies that I see show that the building is going to work. And generally they will, but do they work in a timeline that you underwrote it? You underwrite stabilization to be 24 months. What happens if it takes 36 or 40 months? So those things are going to, you know, cost you money and impact your return.
Exactly. That time is a killer. And I think that on the acquisition front, that reposition, which happens to be my area of expertise, is that when we're talking with investors, and Josh and I have this experience together, is just that timing is a killer. It can be a real make or break, because time costs you money.
Right.
And so having those important pieces of design elements, contractors, bid packages, specs, and all of those things put together in advance, which is very, I don't know if it's easy to do, but it's definitely doable, can really help kind of streamline the process and be a real hack into that really important piece from initial investment to the reposition to getting that ROI that right. you're eventually wanting to have.
Yep.
So this has been an excellent conversation with Tim. Unfortunately, I think we're running out of time. Tim, you've been so gracious with your knowledge. A lot of value back to our listeners here in Chicago that you've given us your time. And so it's just one of those things that we're really excited about. So thank you so much, Josh. Great show, my friend. And I look forward to seeing you soon as well. And it's been another great episode of Bridge the Gap.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks. See you guys.
Meet Josh and Lucas at the Interface Southeast Conference in Atlanta, August 29th. Use promo code BTG at registration and receive 5% off. Thanks for listening to Bridge the Gap.